Trina was traumatized by the boys' deaths and could barely speak when the police arrested her. She was so non-functional and listless that her appointed lawyer thought she was incompetent to stand trial. Defendants who are deemed incompetent can't be tried in adversarial criminal proceedings, meaning that the state can't prosecute them unless they become well enough to defend themselves. Criminally accused people facing trial are entitled to treatment and services, but Trina's lawyer failed to file the appropriate motions or present evidence to support an incompetency determination for Trina. The lawyer, who was subsequently disbarred and jailed for unrelated criminal misconduct, also never challenged the state's decision to try Trina as an adult. As a result, Trina was forced to stand trial for second-degree murder in an adult courthouse. At trial, Frances Newsom testified against Trina in exchange for the charges against her being dropped. Trina was convicted of second-degree murder, and the trial moved to the sentencing phase. Delaware County Circuit Judge Howard Reed found that Trina had no intent to kill. But under Pennsylvania law, the judge could not take the absence of intent into account during sentencing. He could not consider Trina's age, mental illness, poverty, the abuse she had suffered, or the tragic circumstances surrounding the fire. Pennsylvania sentencing law was inflexible. For those convicted of second-degree murder, mandatory life imprisonment without the possibility of parole was the only sentence. Judge Reed expressed serious misgivings about the sentence he was forced to impose. "This is the saddest case I've ever seen," he wrote. For a tragic crime committed at 14, Trina was condemned to die in prison. After sentencing, Trina was immediately shipped off to an adult prison for women. Now 16, Trina walked through the gates of the State Correctional Institution at Muncie, an adult prison for women, terrified, still suffering from trauma and mental illness, and intensely vulnerable, with the knowledge that she would never leave. Prison spared Trina the uncertainty of homelessness, but presented new dangers and challenges. Not long after she arrived at Muncie, a male correctional officer pulled her into a secluded area and raped her. The crime was discovered when Trina became pregnant. As is often the case, the correctional officer was fired, but not criminally prosecuted. Trina remained imprisoned and gave birth to a son. Like hundreds of women who give birth while in prison, Trina was completely unprepared for the stress of childbirth. She delivered her baby while handcuffed to a bed. It wasn't until 2008 that most states abandoned the practice of shackling or handcuffing incarcerated women during delivery. Trina's baby boy was taken away from her and placed in foster care. After this series of events, the fire, the imprisonment, the rape, the traumatic birth, and the seizure of her son, Trina's mental health deteriorated further. Over the years, she became less functional and more mentally disabled. Her body began to spasm and quiver uncontrollably until she required a cane and then a wheelchair. By the time she had turned 30, prison doctors diagnosed her with multiple sclerosis, intellectual disability, and mental illness related to trauma. Trina had filed a civil suit against the officer who raped her, and the jury awarded her a judgment of $62,000. The guard appealed, and the court reversed the verdict because the correctional officer had not been permitted to tell the jury that Trina was in prison for murder. Consequently, Trina never received any financial aid or services from the state to compensate for her being violently raped by one of its correctional officers. In 2014, Trina turned 52. She has been in prison for 38 years. She is one of nearly 500 people in Pennsylvania who have been condemned to mandatory life imprisonment without parole for crimes they were accused of committing when they were between the ages of 13 and 17. It is the largest population of child offenders condemned to die in prison in any single jurisdiction in the world. In 1990, Ian Manuel and two older boys attempted to rob a couple who were out for dinner in Tampa, Florida. Ian was 13 years old. When Debbie Bagri resisted, Ian shot her with a handgun given to him by the older boys. The bullet went through Bagri's cheek, shattering several teeth and severely damaging her jaw. All three boys were arrested and charged with armed robbery and attempted homicide. Ian's appointed lawyer encouraged him to plead guilty, assuring him that he would be sentenced to 15 years in prison. The lawyer didn't realize that two of the charges against Ian were punishable with sentences of life imprisonment without parole. The judge accepted Ian's plea and then sentenced him to life with no parole. Even though he was 13, the judge condemned Ian for living in the streets, for not having good parental supervision, and for his multiple prior arrests for shoplifting and minor property crimes. Ian was sent to an adult prison, the Appalachee Correctional Institution, one of the toughest prisons in Florida. The correctional staff at the prison processing center couldn't find any uniforms that would fit a boy Ian's size, so they cut 6 inches from the bottom of their smallest pants. Juveniles housed in adult prisons are 5 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault, so the staff at Appalachee put Ian, who was small for his age, in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement at Appalachee means living in a concrete box the size of a walk-in closet. You get your meals through a slot. You do not see other inmates, and you never touch or get near another human being. If you act out by saying something insubordinate or refusing to comply with an order given to you by a correctional officer, you are forced to sleep on the concrete floor of your cell without a mattress. If you shout or scream, your time in solitary is extended. If you hurt yourself by refusing to eat or mutilating your body, your time in solitary is extended. If you complain to officers or say anything menacing or inappropriate, your time in solitary is extended. You get 3 showers a week and are allowed 45 minutes in a small caged area for exercise a few times a week. Otherwise, you are alone, hidden away in your concrete box, week after week, month after month. In solitary, Ian became a self-described cutter. He would take anything sharp on his food tray to cut his wrists and arms just to watch himself bleed. His mental health unraveled, and he attempted suicide several times. Each time he hurt himself or acted out, his time in isolation was extended. Ian spent 18 years in uninterrupted solitary confinement. Once a month, Ian was allowed to make a phone call. Soon after he arrived in prison, on Christmas Eve in 1992, he used his call to reach out to Debbie Bagri, the woman he'd shot. When she answered the phone, Ian spilled out an emotional apology, expressing his deep regret and remorse. Ms. Bagri was stunned to hear from the boy who had shot her, but she was moved by his call. She had physically recovered from the shooting and was working to become a successful bodybuilder and had started a magazine focused on women's health. She was a determined woman who didn't let the shooting derail her from her goals. That first surprising phone call led to a regular correspondence. Ian had been neglected by his family before the crime took place. He'd been left to wander the streets with little parental or family support. In solitary, he met few prisoners or correctional staff. As he sank deeper into despair, Debbie Bagri became one of the few people in Ian's life who encouraged him to remain strong. After communicating with Ian for several years, Bagri wrote the court and told the judge who sentenced Ian of her conviction that his sentence was too harsh and that his conditions of confinement were inhumane. She tried to talk to prison officials and gave interviews to the press to draw attention to Ian's plight. No one knows more than I do how destructive and reckless Ian's crime was. But what we're currently doing to him is mean and irresponsible, she told one reporter. When this crime was committed, he was a child, a 13-year-old boy with a lot of problems, no supervision, and no help available. We are not children. The courts ignored Debbie Bagri's call for a reduced sentence. By 2010, Florida had sentenced more than 100 children to life imprisonment without parole for non-homicide offenses, several of whom were 13 years old at the time of the crime. All of the youngest condemned children, 13 or 14 years of age, were Black or Latino. Florida had the largest population in the world of children condemned to die in prison for non-homicides. The section of South Central Los Angeles where Antonio Nunez lived was plagued by gang violence. Antonio's mother would force her children to the floor when shooting erupted outside their crowded home, which happened with disturbing regularity. Nearly a dozen of their neighbors were shot and killed after being caught in the crossfire of gun violence. The difficulties outside Antonio's home were compounded by severe domestic abuse inside the home. From the time Antonio was in diapers, he endured abusive beatings by his father, who hit him with his hand, fist, belt, and extension cords, causing bruises and cuts. He also witnessed terrifying conflicts in which his parents would violently assault each other and threaten to kill one another. The violence was so bad that on more than one occasion, Antonio called the police. He began experiencing severe nightmares from which he awoke screaming. Antonio's depressed mother neglected him. When he cried, she just left him alone. The only activity she could recall ever attending for Antonio was his graduation from a drug abuse resistance education program in elementary school. He was excited to take his picture with the police officer, she would later say. He wanted to be a police officer when he grew up. In September 1999, a month after he turned 13, Antonio Nunez was riding his bicycle near his home when a stranger shot him in the stomach, side, and arm. Antonio collapsed onto the street. His 14-year-old brother Jose heard him screaming and ran to his aid. Jose was shot in the head and killed when he responded to his little brother's call for help. Antonio suffered serious internal injuries that hospitalized him for weeks. When Antonio was released from the hospital, his mother sent him to live with relatives in Las Vegas, where he tried to recover from the tragedy of Jose's death. Antonio was relieved to be away from the dangers of South Central Los Angeles. He stayed out of trouble, was helpful and obedient at home, and spent evenings doing his homework with help from his cousin's husband. He put the gangs and violence of South Central behind him and showed remarkable progress. But within a year, California probation authorities ordered him to return to Los Angeles because he was on probation following his adjudication as a ward of the court for a prior offense. In poor urban neighborhoods across the United States, black and brown boys routinely have multiple encounters with the police. Even though many of these children have done nothing wrong, they are targeted by police, presumed guilty, and suspected by law enforcement of being dangerous or engaged in criminal activity. The random stops, questioning, and harassment dramatically increase the risk of arrest for petty crimes. Many of these children develop criminal records for behavior that more affluent children engage in with impunity. Forced back to South Central, blocks from where his brother was murdered, Antonio struggled. A court later found that, quote, living just blocks from where he was shot and his brother was killed, Nunez suffered trauma symptoms, including flashbacks, an urgent need to avoid the area, a heightened awareness of potential threats, and an intensified need to protect himself from real or perceived threats, end quote. He got his hands on a gun for self-defense but was quickly arrested for it and placed in a juvenile camp where supervisors reported that he eagerly participated in and positively responded to the structured environment and guidance of staff members. After returning from the camp, Antonio was invited to a party where two men twice Antonio's age told him that they were planning to fake a kidnapping to get money from a relative who would pay the ransom. They insisted that Antonio join them. 14-year-old Antonio got in a car with the men to pick up the ransom money. The pretend victim sat in the back seat, while Juan Perez drove and Antonio sat in the passenger seat. Before they arrived at their Orange County destination to retrieve the money, they found themselves being followed and then chased by two Latino men in a gray van. At some point, Perez and the other man gave Antonio a gun and told him to shoot at the van, and a dangerous high-speed shootout unfolded. The men chasing them were undercover police officers, but Antonio didn't know that when he fired. When a marked police car joined the pursuit, Antonio dropped the gun just before the car crashed into some trees. No one was injured, but Antonio and Perez were charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted murder of the police officers. Antonio and his 27-year-old co-defendant were tried together in a joint trial, and both were found guilty. Under California law, a juvenile has to be at least 16 to be sentenced to life imprisonment without parole for murder. But there is no minimum age for kidnapping. So the Orange County judge sentenced Antonio to imprisonment until death, asserting that he was a dangerous gang member who could never change or be rehabilitated, despite his difficult background and the absence of any significant criminal history. The judge sent him to California's dangerous, overcrowded adult prisons. At 14, Antonio became the youngest person in the United States condemned to die in prison for a crime in which no one was physically injured. Most adults convicted of the kinds of crimes with which Trina, Ian, and Antonio were charged are not sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. In the federal system, adults who unintentionally commit arson murder, where more than one person is killed, usually receive sentences that permit release in less than 25 years. Many adults convicted of attempted murder in Florida serve less than 10 years in prison. Gun violence with no reported injuries frequently result in sentences of less than 10 years for adult defendants, even in this era of harsh punishments. Children who commit serious crimes long have been vulnerable to adult prosecution and punishment in many states, but the development of juvenile justice systems has meant that most child offenders were sent to juvenile detention facilities. Juvenile justice systems vary across the United States, but most states would have kept Trina, Ian, or Antonio in juvenile custody until they turned 18 or 21. At most, they might have stayed in custody until age 25 or older if their institutional history or juvenile detention record suggested that they were still a threat to public safety. In an earlier era, if you were 13 or 14 when you committed a crime, you would find yourself in the adult system with a lengthy sentence only if the crime was unusually high profile or committed by a black child against a white person in the South. For instance, in the infamous Scottsboro Boys case in the 1930s, two of the defendants, Roy Wright and Eugene Williams, were just 13 years old when they were wrongfully convicted of rape and sentenced to death in Alabama. In another signature case of juvenile prosecution, George Stinney, a 14-year-old black boy, was executed by the state of South Carolina on June 16, 1944. 3 months earlier, two young white girls who lived nearby in Alkaloo, a small mill town where the races were separated by railroad tracks, had gone out to pick flowers and never returned home. Scores of people across the community went searching for the missing girls. Young George and his siblings joined the search party. At some point, George mentioned to one of the white adult searchers that he and his sister had seen the girls earlier in the day. The girls had approached them while they were playing outside and asked where they could find flowers. The next day, the dead bodies of the girls were found in a shallow ditch. George was immediately arrested for the murders because he had admitted seeing the girls before they disappeared and was the last person to see them alive. He was subjected to hours of interrogation without his parents or an attorney present. The understandable anger about the death of the girls exploded when word circulated that a black boy had been arrested for the murders. The sheriff claimed that George had confessed to the murders, though no written or signed statement was presented. George's father was summarily fired from his job. His family was told to leave town or else they would be lynched. Out of fear for their lives, George's family fled town late that night, leaving George behind in jail with no family support. Within hours of announcing the alleged confession, a lynch mob formed at the jailhouse in Alkaloo, but the 14-year-old had already been moved to a jail in Charleston. A month later, a trial was convened. Facing charges of first-degree murder, George sat alone in front of an estimated crowd of 1,500 white people who had packed the courtroom and surrounded the building. No African Americans were allowed inside the courthouse. George's white court-appointed attorney, a tax lawyer with political aspirations, called no witnesses. The prosecution's only evidence was the sheriff's testimony regarding George's alleged confession. The trial was over in a few hours. An all-white jury deliberated for 10 minutes before convicting George of rape and murder. Judge Stoll promptly sentenced the 14-year-old to death. George's lawyer said there would be no appeal because the family didn't have the money to pay for it. Despite appeals from the NAACP and black clergy who asked that the sentence be converted to life imprisonment, Governor Olin Johnson refused to intervene, and George was sent to Columbia to be executed in South Carolina's electric chair. Small, even for his age, the 5'2", 92-pound Stinney walked up to the chair with a Bible in his hand. He had to sit on the book when prison staff couldn't fit the electrodes to his small frame. Alone in the room, with no family or any people of color present, the terrified child sat in the oversized electric chair. He frantically searched the room for someone to help, but saw only law enforcement personnel and reporters. The adult-sized mask slid off George's face when the first jolt of electricity struck his body. Witnesses to the execution could see his wide-open, tearful eyes and saliva dripping from his mouth. 81 days after being approached by two young girls about where flowers might be found, George Stinney was pronounced dead. Years later, rumors surfaced that a white man from a prominent family confessed on his deathbed to killing the girls. Recently, an effort has been launched to exonerate George Stinney. The Stinney execution was horrific and heartbreaking, but it reflected the racial politics of the South more than the way children accused of crimes were generally treated. It was an example of how policies and norms once directed exclusively at controlling and punishing the black population have filtered their way into our general criminal justice system. By the late 1980s and early 1990s, the politics of fear and anger sweeping the country and fueling mass incarceration was turning its attention to children. Influential criminologists predicted a coming wave of super predators with whom the juvenile justice system would be unable to cope. Sometimes expressly focusing on black and brown children, theorists suggested that America would soon be overcome by elementary school youngsters who packed guns instead of lunches, and who have absolutely no respect for human life. Panic over the impending crime wave expected from these radically impulsive, brutally remorseless children led nearly every state to enact legislation that increased the exposure of children to adult prosecution. Many states lowered or eliminated the minimum age for trying children as adults, leaving children as young as 8 vulnerable to adult prosecution and imprisonment. Some states also initiated mandatory transfer rules, which took away any discretion from prosecutors and judges over whether a child should be kept in the juvenile system. Tens of thousands of children who had previously been managed by the juvenile justice system, with its well-developed protections and requirements for children, were now thrown into an increasingly overcrowded, violent, and desperate adult prison system. The predictions of super predators proved wildly inaccurate. The juvenile population in America increased from 1994 to 2000, but the juvenile crime rate declined, leading academics who had originally supported the super predator theory to disclaim it. In 2001, the Surgeon General of the United States released a report labeling the super predator theory a myth and stated that, quote, "There is no evidence that young people involved in violence during the peak years of the early 1990s were more frequent or more vicious offenders than youths in earlier years," end quote. This admission came too late for kids like Trina, Ian, and Antonio. Their death in prison sentences were insulated from legal challenges or appeals by a maze of procedural rules, statutes of limitations, and legal barricades designed to make successful post-conviction challenges almost impossible. When I met Trina, Ian, and Antonio years later, they had each been broken by years of hopeless confinement. They were legally condemned children hidden away in adult prisons, largely unknown and forgotten, preoccupied with surviving in dangerous, terrifying environments with little family support or outside help. They weren't exceptional. There were thousands of children like them scattered throughout prisons in the United States, children who had been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole or other extreme sentences. The relative anonymity of these kids seemed to aggravate their plight and their despair. I agreed to represent Trina, Ian, and Antonio, and our office would eventually make challenging death in prison sentences imposed on children a major focus of our work. But it became immediately clear that their extreme, unjust sentences were just one of the problems that had to be overcome. They were all damaged and traumatized by our system of justice. Trina's mental and physical health made her life in prison extremely challenging. She was grateful for our help and showed remarkable improvement when we told her that we were going to fight to get her sentence reduced, but she had many other needs. She talked constantly about wanting to see her son. She wanted to know that she was not alone in the world. We tracked down her sisters and arranged a visit where Trina could see her son, and it seemed to strengthen her in ways I wouldn't have thought possible. I flew to Los Angeles and drove hundreds of miles through the heart of Central California farmland to meet Antonio at a maximum security prison dominated by gangs and frequent violence. He was trying to acculturate himself to a world that corrupted healthy human development in every way. Reading had always been challenging for Antonio, but he had a strong desire to learn and was so determined to understand that he would read a passage over and over, looking up unfamiliar words in the dictionary we sent him, until he got it. We recently sent him Darwin's The Origin of Species, which he hopes will help him better understand those around him. It turns out that Ian was very, very bright. Although being smart and sensitive made his extended time in solitary confinement especially destructive, he had managed to educate himself, read hundreds of books, and write poetry and short stories that reflected an eager, robust intellect. He sent me dozens of letters and poems. I'd return to the office after traveling for a few days and often find letters from Ian. Sometimes I'd find within a letter a scrap of wrinkled paper, which, once unfolded, would reveal thoughtful and sobering poems with titles like Uncried Tears, Tied Up with Words, The Unforgiving Minute, Silence, and Wednesday Ritual. We decided to publish a report to draw attention to the plight of children in the United States who had been sentenced to die in prison. I wanted to photograph some of our clients in order to give the life without parole sentences imposed on children a human face. Florida was one of the few states that would allow photographers inside a prison, so we asked prison officials if Ian could be permitted out of his solitary, no-touch existence for an hour, so that the photographer we hired could take the pictures. To my delight, they agreed and allowed Ian to be in the same room with an outside photographer. As soon as the visit was over, Ian immediately wrote me a letter. Dear Mr. Stevenson, I hope this letter reaches you in good health and everything is going well for you. The focal point of this letter is to thank you for the photo session with the photographer and obtain information from you how I can obtain a good amount of photos. As you know, I've been in solitary confinement approximately 14 and a half years. It's like the system has buried me alive and I'm dead to the outside world. Those photos mean so very much to me right now. All I have is $1.75 in my inmate account right now. If I send you a dollar of that, how many of the photos will that purchase me? In my elation at the photo shoot today, I forgot to mention that today, June 19th, was my deceased mom's birthday. I know it's not a big significance, but reflecting on it afterward, it seems symbolic and special that the photo shoot took place on my mother's birthday. I don't know how to make you feel the emotion and importance of those photos, but to be real, I want to show the world I'm alive. I want to look at those photos and feel alive. It would really help with my pain. I felt joyful today during the photo shoot. I wanted it to never end. Every time you all visit and leave, I feel saddened. But I capture and cherish those moments in time, replaying them in my mind's eye, feeling grateful for human interaction and contact. But today, just the simple handshakes we shared was a welcome addition to my sensory-deprived life. Please tell me how many photos I can get. I want those photos of myself almost as bad as I want my freedom. Thank you for making a lot of the positive occurrences that are happening in my life possible. I don't know how exactly the law led you to me, but I thank God it did. I appreciate everything you and EJI are doing for me. Please, send me some photos, okay?
Chapter 9. I'm Here. Finally, the date for Walter McMillan's hearing had arrived. We would now have an opportunity to present Ralph Myers' new testimony and all the exculpatory evidence we'd discovered in police records that had never been disclosed. Michael and I had gone over the case a dozen times, thinking through the best way to present the evidence of Walter's innocence. Our biggest concern was Myers, mostly because we knew he would feel incredible pressure once he was brought back to the county courthouse, and he'd broken under pressure before. We were consoled by the fact that so much of our evidence was documentary and could be admitted without the complications and unpredictability that Myers' testimony might introduce. We now had a paralegal on staff, so we brought her into the case. Brenda Lewis was a former Montgomery police officer who joined us after seeing more abuses of power than she could tolerate at the police department. An African-American woman, she was adept, even in environments where her gender or race made her an outsider. We had asked her to touch base with our witnesses before the hearing to go over last-minute details and calm their nerves. Chapman had called in the state attorney general's office to help defend Walter's conviction, and they'd sent Assistant Attorney General Don Valeska, a longtime prosecutor with a reputation for being intense and combative. Valeska was a white man in his 40s whose fit, medium frame suggested someone who stayed active. The glasses he wore added to his serious demeanor. His brother Doug was the district attorney in Houston County, and both men were aggressive and unapologetic in their prosecution of bad guys. Michael and I had reached out to Chapman once more before the hearing to see if we could persuade him to reopen the investigation and independently re-examine whether McMillan was guilty. But by now, Chapman and all of the law enforcement officers had grown tired of us. They seemed increasingly hostile whenever they had to deal with us. I had considered reporting to them the bomb threats and death threats we'd received, since they were likely coming from people in Monroe County, but I wasn't sure anyone in the sheriff's or DA's office would care. The new judge on the case, Judge Thomas B. Norton, Jr., had also grown weary of us. We'd had several pretrial hearings on different motions during which he would sometimes become frustrated because of the bickering between the lawyers. We kept insisting on obtaining all files and evidence the state had in its possession. We had uncovered so much exculpatory evidence that had not been disclosed previously that we were sure there was still more that had not been turned over. The judge finally told us that we were fishing after we'd made our 9th or 10th request for more police and prosecution files. I suspect that Judge Norton had scheduled the final Rule 32 hearing in part because he wanted to get this contentious, complicated case off his docket and out of his court. In the last pretrial appearance, the judge had asked, "How much time will you need to present your evidence, Mr. Stevenson?" "We'd like to reserve a week, Your Honor." "A week? You've got to be joking. For a Rule 32 hearing? The trial in this case only lasted a day and a half." "Yes, sir, we believe this is an extraordinary case, and there are several witnesses, and 3 days, Mr. Stevenson. If you can't make your case in 3 days after all of this drama you've stirred up, you don't really have anything. Judge, I adjourned." After spending another long day in Monroeville tracking down a few final witnesses, Michael and I went back to the office to plot out how to present all of the evidence in the narrow amount of time the judge was giving us. We needed to make the complexity of the case and the multiple ways that Walter's rights had been violated coherent and understandable to the judge. Another concern was Myers and his love of fantastical narration, so we sat down with him a few days before the hearing and tried to make it as plain as possible. "No long excursions about police corruption," I said. "Just answer the questions accurately and honestly, Ralph."
"I always do," Ralph said confidently.
"Wait, did you just say you always do?" Michael asked. "What are you talking about, you always do? Ralph, you lied through your ass the entire trial. That's what we're going to expose at this hearing."
"I know," Meyer said coolly. "I meant I always tell y'all the truth."
"Don't freak me out, Ralph. Just testify truthfully," Michael said. Ralph had been calling our office almost daily with an unending stream of strange thoughts, ideas, and conspiracies. I was frequently too busy to talk to him, so Michael had been fielding most of the calls and had become increasingly worried about Ralph's unique perspective on the world. But we could do no more about it. We arrived at the courthouse the morning of the hearing early and anxious. We were both dressed in dark suits, white shirts, and muted ties. I usually dressed as conservatively as possible for court. I was a young, bearded black man, and even when there was no jury, I still tried to meet the court's expectation of what a lawyer looked like, if only for the sake of my clients. We first went to check on Myers to make sure he had arrived safely and was in a stable state of mind before the hearing began. The Baldwin County Sheriff's Department deputies had brought Ralph from the prison in St. Clair County to the courthouse the night before the hearing. The five-hour trip through the nighttime roads of southern Alabama had clearly unnerved Ralph. We met with him in his holding cell. He was palpably anxious. Worse, he was quiet and reserved, which was even more unusual. After we finished that unsettling meeting, I went to see Walter, who was also at the courthouse in one of the holding cells. Being back at the courthouse where his fate had seemingly been sealed 4 years earlier had shaken him as well, but he forced himself to smile when I walked in. "Was the trip okay?" I asked. "Everything is good, just hoping for something better than the last time I was here." I nodded sympathetically and reviewed with him what I thought would unfold over the next few days. The holding cells for prisoners were in the basement of the courthouse, and after meeting with Walter, I made my way upstairs to get ready for court to begin. When I walked into the courtroom, I was shocked by what I saw. Dozens of people from the community, mostly black and poor, had packed the viewing area. On both sides of the hearing room, people from Walter's family, people who had attended the fish fry on the day of the crime, people we'd interviewed over the past several months, people who knew Walter from working with him, even Sam Crook and his posse, were crammed into the courtroom. Minnie and Armilla smiled as I walked into court. Tom Chapman then walked in with Don Valeska, and they both scanned the room. I could tell from the looks on their faces that they were unhappy about the crowd. Tate, Larry Eichner, and Benson, the law enforcement team primarily responsible for Walter's prosecution, piled in behind the prosecutors and sat down in the courtroom as well. A deputy sheriff escorted the parents of Rhonda Morrison to the front of the court just before the hearing began. When the judge took the bench, the crowd of black faces noisily rose as one and sat back down. Many of the black community members looked dressed for church. The men were in suits, and some of the women wore hats. It took them a few seconds to settle into silence, which seemed to annoy Judge Norton. But I was energized by their presence and happy for Walter that so many people had come out to support him. Judge Norton was a balding white man in his 50s. He wasn't a tall man, but the elevated bench made him as imposing as any judge. He had managed some of our earlier preliminary hearings in a suit, but today he was in his robe, gavel firmly in hand. "Gentlemen, are we ready to proceed?" Judge Norton asked. "We are, Your Honor," I replied, "but we intend to call several of the law enforcement officers present in the courtroom, and I would like to invoke the rule of sequestration." In criminal cases, witnesses who will be testifying are required to sit outside the courtroom so they can't alter their testimony based on what other witnesses say. Valeska was on his feet immediately. "No, Judge, that's not going to happen. These are the investigators who figured out this heinous crime, and we need them in court to present our case." I stayed on my feet. "The state doesn't bear the burden of presenting a case in these proceedings, Your Honor. We do. This isn't a criminal trial, but a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. Judge, they're the ones that are trying to retry this case, and we need our people inside," Valeska countered. The judge jumped in with, "Well, it does sound like you're trying to retry the case, Mr. Stevenson, so I'm going to allow the state to keep the crime investigators in the courtroom." It was not a good start. I decided to proceed with an opening statement before calling Myers as our first witness. I wanted the judge to understand that we weren't simply defending Mr. McMillan from a different angle than his original lawyers. I wanted him to know that we had dramatic new evidence of innocence that exonerated Walter, and that justice demanded his immediate release. We wouldn't succeed if the judge didn't know how to hear the evidence. "Your Honor, the state's case against Walter McMillan turned entirely on the testimony of Ralph Myers, who had several prior felony convictions and another capital murder case pending against him in Escambia County at the time of Mr. McMillan's trial. At trial, Mr. McMillan asserted that he is innocent and that he did not know Mr. Myers at the time of this crime. He has maintained his innocence throughout these proceedings. The judge had been fidgeting and had seemed distracted when I started, so I paused. Even if he didn't agree, I wanted him to hear what I was saying. I stopped talking until I was sure that he was paying close attention. Finally, he made eye contact with me, so I continued. There is no question that Walter McMillan was convicted of capital murder based on the testimony of Ralph Myers. There was no other evidence to establish Mr. McMillan's guilt for capital murder at trial other than Myers' testimony. The state had no physical evidence linking Mr. McMillan to this crime. The state had no motive. The state had no witnesses to the crime. The state had only the testimony of Ralph Myers. At trial, Myers testified that he was unknowingly and unwillingly made part of a capital murder and robbery on November 1, 1986, when Walter McMillan saw him at a car wash and asked him to drive McMillan's truck because his arm hurt. Myers stated that he drove Mr. McMillan to Jackson Cleaners, subsequently went into the cleaners, and saw McMillan with a gun, placing money in a brown bag. Another man, who was white, was also present in the cleaners. Myers testified this man had black-gray hair and allegedly talked to McMillan. Myers asserted that he was shoved and threatened by Mr. McMillan when he went into the cleaners. The mysterious third person, who is circumstantially presumed to be in charge, allegedly instructed McMillan to get rid of Myers, which Mr. McMillan said he couldn't do because he was out of bullets. The white man in charge has never been identified or arrested by the state. The state has not been looking for a third person, a ringleader for this crime, because I think they recognize that this person doesn't exist. I paused again to let the meaning of this sink in. Based on the testimony of Ralph Myers, Walter McMillan was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. As you're about to hear, the testimony of Ralph Myers was completely false. Again, Your Honor, the testimony of Ralph Myers at trial was completely false. I took a moment before turning to the bailiff to call Myers to the stand. The courtroom was silent until the deputy opened the door to the holding area, and Ralph Myers walked into the courtroom. There was an audible reaction to his presence. Ralph had aged visibly since the last time many of the people in the courtroom had seen him. I could hear murmurs about how his hair had grayed. Dressed in his prison whites, Myers once again appeared small and sad to me as he climbed up onto the witness stand. He looked around the courtroom nervously before raising his hand and swearing an oath to tell the truth. I waited until the courtroom became quiet. Judge Norton was looking at Myers attentively. I walked over to begin my examination. After asking him to state his name for the record and establishing that he had previously appeared in court and testified against Walter McMillan, it was time to get to the heart of things. I walked closer to the witness stand. Mr. Myers, was the testimony that you gave at Mr. McMillan's trial true? I was hoping that the judge couldn't see I was holding my breath, waiting for Ralph to answer. Ralph looked at me coolly, but then spoke very clearly and confidently. Not at all. There was more murmuring in the courtroom now, but the crowd quickly quieted to hear more. Not at all, I repeated before continuing. I wanted Ralph's recantation to sink in, but I didn't want to hesitate too long because we needed a lot more. Did you see Mr. McMillan on the day that Rhonda Morrison was murdered? Absolutely not. Ralph looked steady as he spoke. Did you drive his truck into Monroeville on that day? Absolutely not. Did you go into Jackson Cleaners when Rhonda Morrison was murdered? No, never did. I didn't want the court to think that Ralph was robotically denying everything I asked him, so I asked a question that required an affirmative answer. Now, at Mr. McMillan's trial, did you give some testimony that there was a white man inside the cleaners when you went inside? Yes, I did. I had gone as long as I dared, asking Ralph yes, no questions.
What was that testimony, please?
As I can recall, the testimony was that I had overheard Walter McMillan saying something to this guy, and I had also recalled saying that I had seen the back part of his head, but that's just about all I can recall on that.
Was that testimony true, Mr. Myers?
No, it wasn't.
Now the judge leaned in to listen with rapt attention.
Were any of the allegations you made against Walter McMillan as being involved in the Rhonda Morrison murder true?
Ralph paused and looked around the courtroom before he answered. For the first time, there was emotion in his voice, regret or remorse.
No.
It seemed that everyone in the courtroom had been holding their breath, but now there was an audible buzz from many of Walter's supporters. I had a copy of the trial transcript and took Ralph through every sentence of his testimony against Walter. Statement by statement, he acknowledged that his previous testimony was entirely false. Myers was direct and persuasive. He would frequently turn his head to look Judge Norton directly in the eye as he spoke. When I made him repeat the parts of his testimony about being coerced to testify falsely, Ralph remained calm and conveyed absolute sincerity. Even during the lengthy cross-examination by Chapman, Myers was unwavering. After relentless questioning about why he was changing his testimony and Chapman's suggestion that someone was putting him up to this, Ralph became indignant. He looked at the prosecutor and said,
"Me? I can simply look in your face and anybody else's face, dead eye to eyeball, and tell you that that's all I, anything that was told about McMillan was a lie. As far as I know, McMillan didn't have anything to do with this because on the day they say this happened, I didn't even see McMillan. And that's exactly what I told lots of people."
On redirect examination, I asked Ralph to acknowledge once again that his trial testimony was false and that he had knowingly put an innocent man on death row. Then I took a moment and walked over to the defense table to make sure I hadn't forgotten anything. I reviewed my notes and then glanced at Michael. "Are we okay?" Michael looked astonished. Ralph was great. He was really, really great. I looked at Walter and only then realized that his eyes were moist. He was shaking his head from side to side in disbelief. I put my hand on his shoulder before announcing to the court that Myers could be excused. We had no further questions. Myers stood up to leave the courtroom. As the deputies led him to a side door, he looked apologetically at Walter before being escorted out. I'm not sure Walter saw him. People in the courtroom started whispering again. I heard one of Walter's relatives, in a muted tone, say, "Thank you, Jesus." The next challenge was to rebut the testimony of Bill Hooks and Joe Hightower, who had claimed to see Walter's modified lowrider truck pulling out from the cleaners about the time Rhonda Morrison was murdered. I called Clay Cast to the stand. The white mechanic testified that McMillan's truck was not a low rider in November 1986 when Rhonda Morrison was murdered. Cast had records and clearly remembered modifying Walter's truck in May 1987, over 6 months after the day when Hooks and Hightower claimed they'd seen a low rider truck at the cleaners. We finished the day with Woodrow Eichner, a Monroeville police officer who testified that he was the first on the scene and that the body of Rhonda Morrison was not where Myers had testified it was. Eichner said it was clear from his observation of the murder scene that Morrison had been shot in the back after a struggle that had started in the bathroom and ended in the rear of the cleaners, where the body was found. Eichner's description of the scene contradicted the assertion that Myers had made at trial about seeing Morrison near the front counter. More significantly, Eichner testified that he'd been asked by Pearson, the trial prosecutor, to testify that Morrison's body had been dragged through the store from the front counter to the spot where it was found. Eichner was indignant on the stand as he recalled the conversation. He knew that such testimony would be false, and he told the prosecutors that he refused to lie. He was soon after discharged from the police department. Evidentiary hearings, like jury trials, can be exhausting.
I had done the direct examination of all of the witnesses and was surprised when I realized that it was already 5 p.m. The hearing was going well. I was excited and energized to be able, finally, to lay out all of the evidence proving Walter's innocence. I kept an eye on Judge Norton to make sure he was still engaged, and he seemed visibly affected by the proceedings. I believed the concerned look on his face revealed confusion about what he was going to do in light of this evidence, and I considered the judge's newfound confusion and concern to be real progress. All of the witnesses we called during the first day were white, and none had any loyalties to Walter McMillan. It seemed that Judge Norton had not expected that. When Clay Cast acknowledged that the truck the state witnesses described as a lowrider wasn't modified until close to 7 months after the crime took place, the judge furiously scribbled notes, the worry lines on his face deepening. When Woodrow Eichner announced that he had been fired for trying to be honest about the evidence against McMillan, the judge seemed shaken. This was the first evidence we presented that suggested that people in law enforcement had been so focused on convicting Walter that they were prepared to ignore or even hide evidence that contradicted their case. After Woodrow Eichner completed his testimony, it was deep into the afternoon. The judge looked at the clock and called it a day. I wanted to keep going, to continue until midnight if necessary, but I realized that wasn't going to happen. I walked over to Walter. "We have to stop now?" he asked worriedly. "Yes, but we'll just pick up and keep going tomorrow morning," I smiled at him, and I was pleased when he smiled back. Walter looked at me excitedly. "Man, I can't tell you how I'm feeling right now. All this time I've been waiting for the truth and been hearing nothing but lies. Right now feels incredible. I just... A uniformed deputy walked over and interrupted us. "We need to take him back to the holding cell. You'll have to talk there." The middle-aged white officer seemed provoked. I didn't pay it much attention and told Walter I'd come down later. As people filed out of the courtroom, you could see hope growing among Walter's family. They came up to me and gave me hugs. Walter's sister Armilla, his wife Minnie, and his nephew Giles were all talking excitedly about the evidence we'd presented. When we got back to the hotel, Michael was pumped up too. "Chapman should just call you and say he wants to drop the charges against Walter and let him go home." "Let's not hold our breath waiting for that call," I replied. Chapman had seemed troubled as we left the courthouse. I still had some hope that he might turn around on this and even help us, but we definitely couldn't plan on that. I arrived at the courthouse early the next morning to visit Walter in his basement cell before the proceedings began. When I headed upstairs, I was confused to see a throng of black folks sitting outside the courtroom in the courthouse lobby. It was just about time for the proceedings to begin. I went up to Armilla, who was sitting with the others outside the courtroom, and she looked at me with concern. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Why aren't y'all inside the courtroom?" I looked around the lobby. If there had been a huge crowd yesterday, today's hearing had brought more people, including several clergy members and older people of color I'd never seen before. "They won't let us in, Mr. Stevenson." "What do you mean they won't let you in?" "We tried to go in earlier, and they told us we couldn't come in." A young man in a deputy sheriff's uniform was standing in front of the entrance to the courtroom. I walked over to him, and he put his arm up to stop me. "I want to go into the courtroom," I said firmly. "You can't come in." "What do you mean I can't come in? There's a hearing scheduled and I want to go inside." "I'm sorry, sir, you can't come into the courtroom." "Why not?" I asked. He stood there silently. Finally, I added, "I'm the defense attorney. I think I have to be able to go inside the courtroom." He looked at me closely and was clearly perplexed. I don't know. I'll have to go and check." He disappeared inside the courtroom. He came back a few moments later and grinned at me tentatively. You can come in." I pushed by the deputy, opened the door, and saw that the entire courtroom had been altered. Inside the courtroom door, they had placed a large metal detector, on the other side of which was an enormous German Shepherd held back by a police officer. The courtroom was already half filled. The benches that had been filled by Walter supporters the previous day were now mostly occupied by older white people. Clearly the people here were supporting the Morrisons and the prosecution. Chapman and Valeska were already sitting at the prosecutor's table, acting as if nothing was going on. I was livid. I walked over to Chapman. "Who told the deputies not to let the folks outside come into the courtroom?" I asked. They looked at me as if they didn't know what I was talking about. "I'm going to speak to the judge about this." I spun on my heel and went directly to the judge's chambers, and the prosecutors followed me. When I explained to Judge Norton that McMillan's family and supporters had been told that they couldn't come into the courtroom, even though the state's supporters had been let in, the judge rolled his eyes and looked annoyed. "Mr. Stevenson, your people will just have to get here earlier," he said dismissively. "Judge, the problem isn't that they weren't here early. The problem is that they were told they couldn't come into the courtroom." "No one is being denied entrance into the courtroom, Mr. Stevenson." He turned to his bailiff, who left the room. I followed the bailiff and saw him whisper something to the deputy outside the courtroom. McMillan's supporters would be led into the courtroom now that half the courtroom was already filled. I walked over to where two ministers had assembled all of Walter's supporters and tried to explain the situation. "I'm sorry, everyone," I said. "They've done something really inappropriate today. They'll let you in now, but the courtroom is already half filled with people here to support the state. There won't be enough seats for everyone." One of the ministers, a heavy-set African-American man dressed in a dark suit with a large cross around his neck, walked over to me. "Mr. Stevenson, it's okay. Please don't worry about us. We'll have a few people be our representatives today, and we will be here even earlier tomorrow. We won't let nobody turn us around, sir." The ministers began selecting people to be representatives in the courtroom. They told Minnie, Armilla, Walter's children, and several others to go on in. When the ministers called out Mrs. Williams, everyone seemed to smile. Mrs. Williams, an older black woman, stood up and prepared herself to enter the courtroom. She took great care in fixing her hair just right. On top of her gray hair, she wore a small hat whose placement she precisely adjusted. She then pulled out a long blue scarf that she delicately wrapped around her neck. Only then did she slowly begin to make her way to the courtroom door, where the line of McMillan supporters had formed. I found her dignified ritual riveting, but when the spell was broken, I realized that I needed to get going myself. I hadn't spent the morning preparing for witnesses as I had intended, but had instead been drawn into this foolish mistreatment of McMillan's supporters. I walked past the line of patient people and went inside to begin preparing for the hearing. I was standing at counsel's table when, out of the corner of my eye, I saw that Mrs. Williams had made it to the courtroom door. She was quite elegant in her hat and scarf. She wasn't a large woman, but there was something commanding about her presence. I couldn't help but watch her as she moved carefully through the doorway toward the metal detector. She walked more slowly than everyone else, but she held her head high with an undeniable grace and dignity. She reminded me of older women I'd been around all my life, women whose lives were hard but who remained kind and dedicated themselves to building and sustaining their communities. Mrs. Williams glanced at the available rows to see where she would sit, and then turned to walk through the metal detector. And that's when she saw the dog. I watched all her composure fall away, replaced by a look of absolute fear. Her shoulders dropped, her body sagged, and she seemed paralyzed. For over a minute, she stood there, frozen, and then her body began to tremble and then shake noticeably. I heard her groan. Tears were running down her face, and she began to shake her head sadly. I kept watching until she turned around and quickly walked out of the courtroom. I felt my own mood shift. I didn't know exactly what had happened to Mrs. Williams, but I knew that here in Alabama, police dogs and black folks looking for justice had never mixed well. I was trying to shake off the dark feeling that the morning's events had conjured when the officers brought Walter into the courtroom. Because there was no jury, the judge had not permitted me to give him street clothes to wear, so Walter was wearing his prison uniform.
They allowed him to be in the courtroom without handcuffs, but had insisted on keeping his ankles shackled. Michael and I conferred briefly about the order of witnesses as the rest of McMillan's family and supporters slowly filed through the metal detector, past the dog, and into the courtroom. Despite the state's early morning maneuvers and the bad omen of the dog and Mrs. Williams, we had another good day in court. Evidence from the state mental health workers, who had dealt with Myers after he initially refused to testify in the first trial and was sent to the Taylor Hardin Secure Medical Facility for evaluation, confirmed Myers' testimony from the day before. Dr. Omar Mahabit explained that Myers had told him, then, that the police had framed him to accept the penalty for the murder case that he is accused of, or to testify that the man did. Mahabit reported that Myers categorically denied having anything to do with the alleged crime. He claimed, "I don't know the name of this girl, I don't know the time of the alleged crime, I don't know the date of the alleged crime, I don't know the place of the alleged crime." Mahabit testified that Myers had told him, quote, "They told me to say what they wanted me to say," end quote. Evidence from other doctors further confirmed this testimony. Dr. Norman Poitras from Taylor Hardin explained that Myers had told him that his prior confessions are bogus and were coerced out of him by the police through keeping him physically and psychologically isolated. We presented evidence from Taylor Hardin staffer Dr. Kamal Naji, who said that Myers had told him of another murder that occurred in 1986 where a girl was shot in the laundromat. He said that the police, and also my lawyer, want me to say that I had driven these people to the laundromat and that they shot the girl, but I won't do it. Myers also told Naji, "They threatened me. They want me to say what they want to hear, and if I don't, then they tell me, you're going to the electric chair." We had evidence from a fourth doctor to whom Myers confided that he was being pressured to give false testimony against Walter McMillan. Dr. Bernard Bryant testified that Myers told him, quote, "He did not commit the crime, and that at the time he was incarcerated for the crime, he was threatened and harassed by the local police authorities into confessing he committed a crime," end quote. We emphasized to the court throughout the day's hearing that all of these statements were made by Myers before the initial trial. Not only did these statements make Myers' recantation more credible, but they had also been documented in medical records that had never been turned over to Walter's trial lawyers, as the law required. The U.S. Supreme Court has long required that the prosecution disclose to the defendant anything that is exculpatory or that may be helpful to the defendant in impeaching a witness. The supporters whom the state had brought to court and the victim's family seemed confused by the evidence we were presenting. It complicated the simple narrative they had fully embraced about Walter's guilt and the need for swift and certain punishment. State supporters began to leave the courtroom as the day went on, and the number of black people who were led into the room grew. By the end of that second day, I felt very hopeful. We had maintained a good pace, and the cross-examinations had been shorter than I had expected. I thought we could finish our case in one more day. I was tired but feeling pleased as I walked to my car that evening. To my surprise, I noticed Mrs. Williams sitting outside the courthouse on a bench, alone. She stood when our eyes met. I walked over, remembering how unsettled I had been to see her leave the courtroom. "Mrs. Williams, I'm so sorry they did what they did this morning. They should not have done it, and I'm very sorry if they upset you. But so you know, things went well today. I feel like we had a good day. Attorney Stevenson, I feel so bad. I feel so bad," she said and grabbed my hand. "I should have come into that courtroom this morning. I was supposed to be in that courtroom this morning," she said and began to weep. "Miss Williams, it's all right," I said. "They shouldn't have done what they did. Please don't worry about it." I put my arm around her and gave her a hug. "No, no, no, Attorney Stevenson. I was meant to be in that courtroom. I was supposed to be in that courtroom." "It's okay, Mrs. Williams, it's okay." "No, sir, I was supposed to be there, and I wanted to be there. I tried. I tried. Lord knows I tried, Mr. Stevenson. But when I saw that dog..." She shook her head and stared away with a distant look. "When I saw that dog,
I thought about 1965 when we gathered at the Eben Pettus Bridge in Selma and tried to march for our voting rights. They beat us and put those dogs on us.
She looked back to me sadly.
I tried to move, Attorney Stevenson. I wanted to move, but I just couldn't do it.
As she spoke, it seemed like a world of sadness surrounded her. She let go of my hand and walked away. I watched her get into a car with some other people I had seen in the courtroom earlier. I drove back to the motel in a more somber mood to start preparing for the last day of hearings. I arrived at the court early the next morning to make sure that there were no problems. As it turned out, very few people showed up to support the state. And though the metal detector and the dog were still there, no deputy stood at the door to block black people from entering the courtroom. Inside the courtroom, I noticed one of the women I'd seen leave with Mrs. Williams the night before. She came up to me and introduced herself as Mrs. Williams' daughter. She thanked me for trying to console her mother. When she got home last night, she was so upset. She didn't eat anything, she didn't speak to anybody, she just went to her bedroom. We could hear her praying all night long. This morning she called the Reverend and begged him for another chance to be a community representative at the hearing. She was up when I got out of bed, dressed and ready to come to court. I told her she didn't have to come, but she wouldn't hear none of it. She's been through a lot, and, well, on the trip down here she just kept saying over and over, "Lord, I can't be scared of no dog. I can't be scared of no dog." I was apologizing again to the daughter for what the court officials had done the day before when suddenly there was a commotion at the courtroom door. We both looked up, and there stood Mrs. Williams. She was once again dressed impeccably in her scarf and hat. She held her handbag tight at her side and seemed to be swaying at the entrance. I could hear her speaking to herself, repeating over and over again, "I ain't scared of no dog. I ain't scared of no dog." I watched as the officers allowed her to move forward. She held her head up as she walked slowly through the metal detector, repeating over and over, "I ain't scared of no dog." It was impossible to look away. She made it through the detector and stared at the dog. Then, loud enough for everyone to hear, she belted out, "I ain't scared of no dog." She moved past the dog and walked into the courtroom. Black folks who were already inside beamed with joy as she passed them. She sat down near the front of the courtroom and turned to me with a broad smile and announced, "Attorney Stevenson, I'm here. Mrs. Williams, it's good to see you here. Thank you for coming." The courtroom filled up and I started getting my papers together. They brought Walter into the courtroom, the signal that the hearing was about to begin. That's when I heard Mrs. Williams call my name. "No, Attorney Stevenson, you didn't hear me. I said I'm here." She spoke very loudly, and I was a little confused and embarrassed. I turned around and smiled at her. No, Mrs. Williams, I did hear you, and I'm so glad you're here." When I looked at her, though, it was as if she was in her own world. The courtroom was packed, and the bailiff brought the court to order as the judge walked in. Everyone rose, as is the custom. When the judge took the bench and sat down, everyone else in the courtroom sat down as well. There was an unusually long pause as we all waited for the judge to say something. I noticed people staring at something behind me, and that's when I turned around and saw that Mrs. Williams was still standing. The courtroom got very quiet. All eyes were on her. I tried to gesture to her that she should sit, but then she leaned her head back and shouted, "I'm here!" People chuckled nervously as she took her seat. But when she looked at me, I saw tears in her eyes. In that moment, I felt something peculiar, a deep sense of recognition. I smiled now because I knew she was saying to the room, "I may be old, I may be poor, I may be black, but I'm here. I'm here because I've got this vision of justice that compels me to be a witness. I'm here because I'm supposed to be here. I'm here because you can't keep me away." I smiled at Mrs. Williams while she sat proudly. For the first time since I started working on the case, everything we were struggling to achieve finally seemed to make sense. It took me a minute to realize that the judge was calling my name and patiently asking me to begin.
The last day of hearings went well. There were a half dozen people who had been jailed or imprisoned with Ralph Myers, whom Ralph had told he was being pressured to give false testimony against Walter McMillan. We found most of them and had them testify. They were consistent in what they related. Isaac Daly, who had been falsely accused by Myers of committing the Pittman murder, explained how Myers had falsely implicated Walter in the Pittman crime. Myers had confided to Daly after he was arrested that he and Karen had discussed pinning the Pittman murder on Walter. He related to us that he and Karen did the killing and plotted together to put it off on Johnny D. Another inmate who wrote letters for Myers at the Monroe County Jail explained that Myers didn't know McMillan, had no knowledge of the Morrison murder, and was being pressured by police to testify falsely against McMillan. We saved the most powerful evidence for the end. The tapes that Tate, Benson, and Eichner had made when they interrogated Myers were pretty dramatic. The multiple recorded statements Myers gave to the police featured Myers repeatedly telling the police that he didn't know anything about the Morrison murder or Walter McMillan. They included the officer's threats against Myers and Myers' resistance to framing an innocent man for murder. Not only did the tapes confirm Myers' recantation and contradict his trial testimony, they exposed the lie that Pearson had told the court, the jury, and McMillan's trial counsel that there were only two statements provided by Myers. In fact, Myers gave at least six additional statements to the police that were largely consistent with his testimony at the Rule 32 hearing that he had no information about Walter McMillan committing the Rhonda Morrison murder. All of these recorded statements were typed, exculpatory, and favorable to Walter McMillan, and none of them had been disclosed to McMillan's attorneys, as was required. I called on McMillan's trial lawyers, Bruce Boynton and J.L. Chestnut, to testify about how much more they could have done to win an acquittal if the state had turned over the evidence it had suppressed. We finished the presentation of our evidence, and to our surprise, the state put on no rebuttal case. I didn't know what they could have presented to rebut our evidence, but I assumed they would present something. The judge seemed surprised, too. He paused and then said he wanted the parties to submit written briefs, arguing what ruling he should make. We had hoped for this, and I was relieved that the court would give us time to explain the significance of all the evidence in writing and assist him in preparing his order, an order I hoped would set Walter free. At the end of 3 days of intense litigation, the judge adjourned the proceedings in the late afternoon. Michael and I had been in a rush the final morning of the hearing and hadn't checked out of our hotel before leaving the courthouse. We said our farewells to the family in the courtroom and went back to the hotel, feeling exhausted but satisfied. Bay Minette, where the hearing took place, is about 30 minutes from the beautiful beaches on the Gulf of Mexico. We had started a tradition of bringing our staff down to the beach each September, and we'd all fallen in love with the clear, warm waters of the Gulf. The white sand and pleasantly underdeveloped beachfront were spectacular and soothing. The view was slightly spoiled by the massive offshore oil rigs you could see in the distance, but if you could make yourself forget about them, you'd think you were in paradise. Dolphins loved this part of the Gulf and could be spotted in the early mornings, playfully making their way through the water. I'd often thought we should move our office to right there on the beach. It was Michael's idea to hit the beach before heading back to Montgomery. I wasn't sure it was a good idea, but the day was warm and the coast was so close, I couldn't resist. We jumped in the car, trailing the last hours of sunlight to the beautiful shores near Fort Morgan, Alabama. As soon as we got there, Michael changed from his suit to swim trunks and went sprinting into the ocean. I was too tired to race into the sea, so I put on some shorts and sat down at the water's edge. It would soon be dusk, but the heat persisted. My head was full of everything that had transpired in court. I was replaying what witnesses had said and worrying about whether things had gone exactly right. I was trawling through every detail in my mind, every possible misstep, until I caught myself. It was over. There was no point in making myself crazy by overthinking it now. I decided to dive into the ocean and, for a moment at least, forget it all. Recently, stranded at the airport with nothing else to read, I'd read an article about shark attacks. As I approached the waves at Fort Morgan, now lit by the sunset,
I remembered that sharks feed at dusk and at dawn. I watched Michael swimming far offshore, and as fun as it looked, I knew I'd be the more vulnerable target if a shark showed up. Michael swam like a fish while I barely stayed afloat. Michael waved at me and shouted, "B-man, come on out!" I cautiously ventured into the water far enough to explain my concerns about sharks to him. He laughed at me. The water felt warm and wonderful, comforting in a way I hadn't expected. A school of fish zipped by my legs, and I stared at them in wonder until I realized that they might be fleeing some larger predator. I carefully made my way back to the shore. I sat on the sandy shore and watched the brilliant white pelicans gliding effortlessly over the still waters in search of food. Small fiddler crabs scurried around me, too fearful to get close but curious enough to linger nearby. I thought about Walter making his way back to Holman, shackled in the back of that van again. I wanted him to be hopeful but grounded enough to manage whatever the court decided. I thought about his family and all the people who had come to court. They'd kept the faith through the 5 years that had passed since Walter was first arrested, and now they had cause to feel energized and encouraged. I thought about Mrs. Williams. She had come up to me after the hearings and had given me a sweet kiss on the cheek. I told her how happy I was she'd come back to court. She looked at me playfully. "Attorney Stevenson, you know I was going to be here, and you know I wasn't going to let these people keep me out." Her words had made me smile. Michael got out of the water looking worried. "What did you see?" I joked. "Shark? Eel? Poisonous jellyfish? Stingray? Piranha?" He was out of breath. "They've threatened us? Lied to us? There are people who have told us that some folks in the county are so unnerved by what we're doing they're going to kill us. What do you think they're going to do now that they know how much evidence we have to prove Walter's innocence?" I had given this some thought, too. Our opponents had done everything they could to frame Walter in order to kill him. They'd lied to us and subverted the judicial process. More than a few people had passed on to us that they'd heard angry people in the community making threats on our lives because they believed we were trying to help a guilty murderer get off death row. "I don't know," I told Michael, "but we have to press on, man. We've got to press on." We both sat there in silence, watching the sun fade into darkness. More fiddler crabs emerged from their holes, scurrying crazily and getting closer to where we sat. I turned to Michael in the approaching darkness. "We should go."